Support for the Morning Show comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. Support for the Morning Show also comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. And we welcome you to the Friday Morning Show on WGTD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. If today is Friday, that means tomorrow is Saturday, and tomorrow means then it's time to visit once again Kenosha's Harbor Market. And so we're really happy that we can have with us on the morning show today two of the busiest people behind the scenes, and not always behind the scenes either, sometimes front and center, Ray Forgiani, who is president of Kenosha Common Markets, and Melanie Hovey, who is secretary. And this is also good timing, not only because tomorrow is Saturday, but because next Wednesday will mark the opening of the Westosha Market, which is in a slightly different location. But I think that expansion began last year. That was the first experiment with taking sort of the magic and excitement of Harbor Market out west into into the county, so to speak. And it was a fine success, and they are hoping for to build on that success even further with this this further expansion. And of course, there are other things to talk about as well in terms of potential growth and exciting new ventures for all of this, and we'll take some time with that as well. Ray Forgiani, Melanie Hovey, we welcome both of you back to the morning show.
Good morning.
Good to have both of you here. Ray, you've been so busy with this for such a long time, and I don't think it hurts to start with a little bit of history. So if you would, just trace a little bit of how Harbor Market came into being and what it was that prompted you to work so hard to see it come into being.
I think the reason it started, there was a couple of reasons. One, I've been interested in, well, we'll put it this way. When we'd go on vacation, my kids would know this, my wife certainly knows this, that we'd always go and look at streetscapes, parks, and markets, both indoor public markets as well as outdoor open-air markets, wherever we went. That was always one of the things we always looked for in a community because we found them fun. Hmm. That started with me seeing a public market in Toronto, the I forget the name of it, but it'll come to me in due time. And I just loved the place. And from my standpoint, anytime I traveled in my previous job as a city planner, I always, when I saw something I liked, then I wanted that in my community. I wanted it by my house. So I didn't have to travel halfway around the world to see something and enjoy it. At the same time, we were the city was working on the redevelopment of the lakefront site, the former Simmons, Nash, AMC, Renault, Chrysler site, and that as we designed it, it was clear since about a third of the site had to be used for public purposes or navigational, that a market would fit into it. So almost from the beginning of its design, it was contemplated there would be a market. Partway through the process after construction was all underway, worked with then Mayor Antaramian if we could set up an ad hoc committee to study the feasibility. So off the record, you might say, off the table, I assembled people that I thought would be necessary to develop the concept. Melanie was one of them. In fact, we still have many of those same original people. But we met a handful of times, concluded we had a really tight time frame, but we thought we'd try it anyway. We went back to the mayor with a report. He then developed an ordinance. Actually, I wrote it. It's created a committee to start the market with a sunset provision. The idea was to start it under the city's umbrella, and then since it really is a private activity, to get it out from underneath the city. I share this concept with John that there's things government does better than the private sector, but there's things the private sector does better than the public sector. And having a government that would initiate, enhance, and support an activity then allows it to happen. So that's where it started. Within 2 years, the sunset was going to close. We created a not-for-profit corporation, and we were already operating as a committee as at the market, and then we spun it off as a not-for-profit corporation. And then it simply has grown from there. We started with 18 vendors the first week, and by the end of that summer, we were to 39, and now we're approaching something like 150 to 170 this summer. Our crowds have been, so far this year, there are around 8,000, 9,000 people per weekend.
Fabulous.
Let me add one other thing about it, and that's it. Right now we're doing about $50,000 worth of business every Saturday. That's just within the market itself. That's a lot of money to bring into a community in one day. And a study that we had done about 10 years ago indicated the spinoff effect in the surrounding area, the downtown in particular, was probably three times that. So you look at the impact of it, and you say, well, it's a lot of things that's not directly attached to the downtown. But when people – and they're coming from out of town as well as locally. When they come, they will spend money on breakfast. They'll spend money on lunch. And as we've pointed out, once we've got him here first thing in the morning, then we can keep him here through most of the day because there's other things to do.
Right. So if you pop into a museum or buy something at Bjorn's or whatever it might be, the city of Kenosha is better for it.
And the effect is even more profound than that. There are stores, retailers that are further west that they know when the market starts and they want to close because their volume just picks up. So they come to the market, then they make other stops because there's other things, other great things in Kenosha to acquire.
Absolutely.
To enjoy.
Back to kind of the creation of the market. First of all, remind us of when exactly that was, that opening day with 18 vendors. What year was that?
2003.
Thank you.
Now, ahead of that, what kind of a timeline are we talking about? I mean, for how many months or how many years did the committee meet? I mean, laying the groundwork before that market first opened.
I think it was less than 6 months. I think it was like three or four months.
So you weren't kidding when you said.
No, it was compressed.
Wow.
But we had a good representation. UW Extension was represented, the county health department.
Parks department.
We had artists like Melanie. We had a vendor like Curzio Caravate. So we do really tried to get – and we had the Convention and Visitors Bureau represented. The idea was to get those people that would likely have special talents that would be needed to make it work. So we had PR covered. We had the arts covered. We had food covered. We had the health department and then the county extension. So it actually was a very, very, I think, strong group, and it really laid a good foundation for the organization we have today.
Hmm. How much discussion occurred at the time about exactly where it should be located? And were there competing ideas about the best place for it to be? Or right from the start, was it just absolutely clear that this was the one and only place where it could be located? I don't mean throughout the city. I mean, I think everybody understands why it's generally where it is. But I mean exactly on that particular street. Or was that just a no-brainer decision actually or easily arrived at?
Well, it actually started on Plaza Douay, and that was the intent to do the plaza there. And even back then we had talked about a public market also being located on that site. When the harbor front development occurred, however, they needed the plaza for its marshaling of the construction equipment. So the plaza was closed off to us. And I viewed that location extremely important for a number of market reasons. One, it's a beautiful site. Two, there's some traffic volume that you can pick up from the museums. The condos are right there, and the marinas right there. Those are all not necessarily profit centers, but those are all groups of people with disposable income. So my take immediately is let's move to the street. Let's go down 2nd Avenue. Since that is covered under the lake band requirement, everything from the west side of 2nd Avenue east is covered under the Northwest Territorial Ordinance. We're going back in history. So what it requires, it's either public or navigational. It can't really be used for private purposes where the public can attend without difficulty. As an example, a white cloth restaurant couldn't locate there, but a hot dog stand could. So that was the first choice. There was certainly a push to move us out of the site entirely. Some people wanted us over by City Hall. But we knew from our previous experience, the closer you are to the lake without buildings blocking, the windier it is, the more problems you have. So there was a strong push to put us that way, and there was a strong push to push us in the downtown. We did try that for one weekend. It was not a good fit. Mm-hmm. So we stayed pretty strongly to stay in Second Avenue. Now as time goes on, we've expanded it. So at Second Avenue, the plaza opened up again. We expanded in, back into the plaza. Now we're expanding down 56th Street, moving it west to make a better connection with the downtown. I visited a market in Arles, France. That must have been a mile long. And I realized if the French can do it, then we can do it. Not that we have any advantage over them, but they've certainly got probably an extra millennium of experience in markets that we don't have. And right. It worked there. It was a delightful market. And I said, well, we can aim for the same thing. So far, we haven't found a cap on how big we can be. We continue to attract new vendors and new customers. Mm.
For those of you just joining us, we're speaking with Ray Forgiani and Melanie Hovey about Harbor Market. And this coming Wednesday will be the opening day for the Westosha Market. And we'll be talking about that in just a moment. So the market has, as you've just said, has grown dramatically in terms of number of vendors and the number of customers and so on. It's just continuing to move from strength to strength. What are the criteria of the vendors who are invited to and or allowed to sell their wares at Harbor Market? We get the sense that it isn't just come on down, whoever you are, and sell whatever you want. I mean,
that's exactly right.
You have some careful restrictions, although I don't know that to the casual visitor it would be immediately apparent just what those restrictions are.
And they're not supposed to be apparent to the public.
Exactly.
We've taken a stance very much like Disney. You never want to see the characters out of costume. So what goes on behind the scenes, you're not supposed to see. You're just supposed to come to the market and enjoy yourself.
Right. It should feel very spontaneous, right. and I think it does. And yet, it isn't as spontaneous as it might seem. There are some careful guidelines. So give us some sense of what those guidelines are in terms of who can sell what at Harbor Market.
Well, we have various categories that of vendors, and our committees, as part of our board, we make selections on attracting new vendors and approving new vendors. We try to make it so that everybody can make a little money, so we wouldn't have, 15 soap vendors. We would keep it at a smaller number. So certainly that, but then just definitely the quality. We jury every work that comes in, every piece of artwork and food and stuff like that. So
for instance, some potter someplace with pottery, they show you their pottery, and
yes.
you decide this is good.
Correct.
Pottery, or this is, wow, that,
yes.
That I didn't even realize.
It's local, so it has to be artist made, or it's local. You'll see the farmer that is in the booth with their food. So that's probably one of the main things, is that very, very few people can bring things from that they did not produce.
And the things that they did not produce, we do allow, but they have to be very unique. Imports, as an example, we may allow imports that might be hard to find in the region. So we've had everything from African art to Indonesian jewelry. It would be two examples. For a while, we had Provence tablecloths.
But
as
we
an
care
example.
Very much about fair trade, and we care very much about organic. So we give preference always to top quality products.
So a potential vendor has to submit an application. They have to give us background, tell us what they propose to sell. They have to supply pictures, or if it's food, prepared food particularly, or processed food, they have to work through the health department. And we've kept a sanitarian on the board from the beginning, so that there's a good seamless connection between the two. So if a prepared food vendor, let's say called myself or Melanie, that's the first thing we tell them is to call a health department, talk to a sanitarian, make sure that what you're proposing to do is legal, that it meets health standards, and get your proper permits. Once you've got that in line, then submit your application.
Hmm. when it comes to escalating quality, do you find that someone that was a vendor at one point, you're tempted to discard them in favor of somebody who's even bigger and even better? Or have you really gone for quality right from the start?
I don't think it's so much picking one over another, but there are vendors who we've not approved in subsequent. You have to reapply every year. Hmm. It's every year it's a new application. And it's because we do watch our vendors. It's not enough just to get in. We do expect vendors to be easy to work with. We expect them to follow the rules. We expect them to be provide that tone of happiness.
Hmm.
So there are vendors over the years that we simply have not allowed to return because they didn't add to that that ambiance, or they took away from it.
Right.
And they weed themselves out, too, because better quality products, the customers are going to go and purchase those, and then their sales drop. The ones that are not are more inferior, and so they weed themselves out as well.
Right. I mean, they don't want to waste their time, and,
exactly.
and they plunk down some money to be part of this,
exactly.
right? Yeah. Talk about the actual shaping, the construction of the market in terms of who is where. Is that a complicated matter?
That's crazy.
Yes, it is complicated. It's complicated since we're not a market where you have to sign up for every day the whole year. We allow people to come as few times as one. So the number or the who's in the market can change fairly dramatically from week to week. That happens. We really like when vendors come every week. Someone may see something and we come the next week and where are they? They're not here. So as a result, the layout is relatively complicated.
It's
that's
so
one
fluid.
Of the reason, it's one of the reasons we've got you submit an application, there's a 2-week delay because we have to have enough time for Curzio to do the layout and then for us to have the maps that go with it.
Hmm. So do people end up, in a sense, at least largely staying where they have been? And are there certain locations that are regarded as sort of prime location that other vendors aspire to?
Food tends to stay in the same place because electricity is only in one place.
Hmm.
It's on the east side of 2nd Avenue, so you'll see most of those vendors there. And the people that are there for the whole season are most generally in exactly the same spot. That's a benefit of being willing to sign up for the whole year, then you get the same spot.
Very good. So what kinds of charting have you done over the years in terms of how many people are coming, what they're buying, who's doing well? It seems to me that's probably not the easiest thing to keep track of.
Well, we're really not concerned how each individual vendor does. We really think that's a private matter between them and their customer. But the metrics from the very first year, we counted visitors. We do a random count every half hour, and then you'd like to get a more accurate count, but when you're dealing with thousands of people, you can't count everyone that comes in all day long. So every half hour we go out and do a count, and then we total it at the end of the day. That estimate is fairly accepted across the country now. Right now, we're also involved in a market impact analysis, see how strong the market is as we start to prepare to do some bigger things so we can put a value to the market. So we're collecting data each week anonymously from each vendor to see what their estimated sales are for each day. That's where I said that number's been around 50,000 per week so far.
Hmm. And that's, I think you said,
it's not easy to do, believe me.
Right.
There's a certain amount of suspicion, which is understandable. Vendors assume that you're collecting the data so you can raise the rates. Or they view it's going to be turned over to the IRS or the State
right.
Department.
Well, and you yourself just said you, to a large extent, regard it as a private matter,
right.
how each one of these vendors is doing. Yeah, and yet, for the overall good of the market and for some of your future plans, you need to have at least some data of that kind.
Yeah, we'd like to be able to put a price tag on what the value of the market is. So we're involved in this impact analysis, which is actually coming out of the FDA Main Street program, thanks to Chris Nauman. He got us involved in this. Also, the University of Wisconsin-Madison and UW Extension. So it's a pretty rigorous effort. We're going to be doing some counts in the next few weeks where we actually will count for 20 minutes of each hour at every entry point. And thank goodness we've got a volunteer organization, some students actually from Gateway, that one of our vendors is a coordinates. So he's offered that, and that'll make that possible. We scratched our head for a while how we were going to accomplish it.
Yeah. Do you know, and secondly, do you care where your customers come from? In other words, do you think it ultimately matters how many of those customers at Harbor Market are Kenoshans or Racinians or from Milwaukee or from Illinois? Does that really matter? Have you done anything to try to even determine that?
We did a zip code study a couple of years ago, and we will probably have we're going to do something similar with this impact analysis.
And how does that work?
Are we trying to reach to other people? Well, certainly, but I think it's no much different than any other retailer. As long as people are spending money, you're not too concerned where they're coming from. But it is interesting to know what our reach is, how far we reach in terms of, and I've been amazed from after probably our eighth year, just how far the reach is. We've got people that will come in from the very southern end of Lake County and all the way into Milwaukee County, and despite the fact that there's competing open-air markets on the same day at the same time, they would rather travel an hour, 50 minutes, to come to this market. But the largest, it's about 50%, is people from within the city, which one would expect. It's just no different than a grocery store.
Right.
If you were to look at Woodman's, their reach is pretty far, but the main part of their reach is still within the county.
Let's talk about Mother Nature for a moment. What happens on those unfortunate occasions when the weather really turns rotten? First of all, is it your call, Ray, or your committee as a whole, collectively, in terms of the market will not open today, or the market's going to close early today, or is that up to each individual vendor, how long they want to hang in there? How is that handled?
We have never not opened. We open rain or shine. So the market's always operated. It can be hampered by rain and wind. Those are the two primary, and or excessive heat. We have closed early on occasion. I mean, if it's noon and you can see through radar, fantastic technology today to really know what the weather is going to be in an hour.
Right.
And you can see that a very heavy storm, we have closed an hour early. We've had slow openings where it's rained at 8 o'clock, so you expect not to be at top performance at 9. And then in terms of vendors leaving, we will allow a vendor to leave. They can't bring their vehicle in, but if you've got stuff, material or product which is pretty sensitive to the weather, you know, that rain would destroy it or wind would knock it down and break it, and you know, we understand that those people do have an obligation to themselves to be able to leave. But you find that the far majority, more than the majority, a super majority of the vendors will stick it out. It's an averaging game. You know, you get great weeks and then you get weak weeks, and if you're there every week, it averages out.
And you know those customers that come out, they're dedicated customers that are looking to spend money, so the vendors realize that and they stick around.
Right.
Well, part of it, the produce in general, you know, if you use eggs during the week, you need eggs every week. You don't need them eggs once in a while. You're not going to afford to go food for the whole week.
Right. And if you're interested in farm fresh eggs that the quality of which you really appreciate, then you'll brave a few raindrops or whatever.
Yeah.
And the other thing is that produce ideally is going to be sold that day. I mean, it's not like a piece of pottery that's the same piece of pottery a month later.
They'll run in and maybe won't stay as long, but they'll pick up the things that they came for.
Right.
And that's worth a vendor sticking around for.
Very good. Let's talk about the expansion that began last year.
Yes.
Out into the county. And the relocation of that expanded market, the Westosha market. First of all, just not in great detail, but just remind us about how that expansion took place last year. What prompted it? Anything in particular?
I think there were two factors. We had some difficulty with the prior site. Its location, although somewhat visible to the Highway 50, did make us scared a number of occasions because of the speed of the traffic and then people suddenly stopping or people exiting and crossing the median.
Do I remember this was at 50 and 45?
Yeah, roughly.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so that was part of it. The it's got an unpaved parking lot, which led to some problems. As an example, I had two flat tires.
Oh.
And then the level of service. The other factor, and it's probably the stronger factor, is the investment that's coming out to Willimon Hill. I mean, there's no question that the Vail Corporation is going to make Willimon Hill the scale hill for Chicago. I mean, it's an international resort company, and they're what $13 million they're putting in about 2 years into that hill. So it's very clear they're going to turn it into something very special. From an economic development standpoint, I think that really changes a lot in western Kenosha County. And that's a winter activity, but I know the way resorts work, they have expenses year-round, so they'll be working to keep that facility going year-round. So we see some spin-off effects from it. And then the second one
is the site itself. The Kenosha County Fairgrounds, where we've moved to, has all the amenities. They've regularly pumped thousands of people through it. Mm. They have real bathrooms. They have paved walkways. They have huge parking. So it just made a lot of sense for us to move to that new location.
Mm. What was involved logistically in terms of securing that as a site? I mean, for instance, who owns that? Who owns that property, and what were your interactions like?
And I don't think the county owns it. I believe it's owned by the Fairgrounds Association.
Oh, okay.
They are another not-for-profit corporation. They work closely with the county and the township of Salem.
Mm-hmm.
So the process was really working with them,
a
very easy group to work with. And then getting
a new director.
And then, yes, a new executive director who's very innovative and forthright in getting new activities there. And then working with the county zoning and planning, and couldn't be any easier to work with. And then with the Town of Salem's Plan Commission and Town Board, you know, one meeting, amiable.
Hmm. And I suppose it makes sense. I mean, otherwise you have these fairgrounds that are sitting there idle and empty,
right.
And in a sense, nobody is particularly fond of that. So this seems like one of those proverbial win-win scenarios.
Absolutely.
Hmm. So, Melanie, this is kind of your baby, I think, right? The expanded site, you are involved in quite a lot of the oversight of it.
Yes.
First of all, just tell us a little bit about how it went last summer, given the, you know, some of the limitations of the site. Despite that, was it an encouraging enough success? I mean, I would guess so, since you're carrying on.
It was absolutely a success. I mean, being right on Highway 50, the exposure was very great. And just knowing so many vendors from Harbor Market, so that many of them were willing to give the new venture a try.
Mm.
And so, you know, going out there on a different day of the week made sense for them as well.
It was Wednesdays, is that right?
Yes.
Like this year as well?
Yeah, mm-hmm. Wednesdays.
Mm-hmm. So how many vendors were there?
Last year, there was between 20 and 25 almost every week.
Not bad.
And I think this year we'll start just about that, mm-hmm. that much here at Wilmot.
So just a little larger than the first Harbor Market.
Yes.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So what's involved in these next few days for you, Melanie, in terms of laying the groundwork for Wednesday?
Well, I mean, we write our newsletter and we feature a few vendors, and I call everybody and email everybody and say, are we all ready? And, you know, just a lot of you rah-rah, but I mean, we know what we're doing. We've been doing it for 14 years, and I think it's just more going there and being positive about it and knowing that there's going to be a few little hitches here and there, but for the most part, everybody has got a great attitude. The vendors are all people that love these kinds of things, and I think it's just going to be great. It's going to be fine.
So what are the hours on Wednesday?
It's 2:30 to 6:30. Every Wednesday from this coming Wednesday, July 6th, all the way to the last Wednesday in September, which is the 28th.
Okay. And that won't run into the Kenosha County Fair?
It will run into the Kenosha County Fair, which that week we won't operate. That's August 17th.
Oh, okay.
So that one week we won't operate. as much as we begged, they said no.
That might have been a little bit interesting. Yeah.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
Very good. Ray, are there any new vendors at Harbor Market this year that you want to tell us about?
Yes, there's always new vendors. We certainly have more meat vendors, more high-quality pork and beef. We've got definitely more prepared food. I think the diversity of the ethnic food now is, boy, it's like you're in a big city.
Yeah,
everything from Ecuadorian empanadas to East African food. Trying to remember them all. There's crepes. We now have a pizza oven. We have someone who's got a wood-burning pizza oven they bring each week.
Yeah, that's pretty cool.
Pizza's very close to being in Naples.
Hmm.
I mean, it's not American pizza. It's really good, but not American pizza. I say this. Have you ever had a bad pizza? It's hard to eat bad pizza, but there's pizzas which are better, and this is fresh. It's
well, there's certainly hot. Pizzas that are more Italian.
Definitely. Wow. So there's a broad variety, more produce. We've attracted a lot among vendors, who I give a great deal of credit to how hard they work on their farms.
And how far they travel to be with us. That's really wonderful. We have them from farmers from Madison and Milwaukee. And then Michigan, the fruit.
Oh, yeah. Well, we worked hard on that to get a fruit vendor. We had a fruit vendor from Michigan who basically felt rejected out of the green market in Chicago. And he was coming regularly until that bad frost we had a few years ago that happened in the spring. And the guy was well into his 80s, him and his wife. So I call him, and he apologized. He says, Ray, I just can't do it. I'm too old. But he says, let me talk to my neighbor.
Ah.
So I called the neighbor up after he talked to him. And Churchill travels from Miles, Michigan.
Every Saturday.
Wow. They actually carried much of the fruit that our old vendor had. This old vendor was really unique because they were both molecular biologists. They had bred fruit. He had his own patented peaches, flying flame, something like that.
Yeah.
And so we're getting the same fruit, different vendor. Most people, I think, don't realize that the other side of Lake Michigan has a different climate. It's a microclimate. On this side, we say cooler near the lake. On their side, it's warmer by the lake in the winter and cooler in the summer. The result is they have a much longer growing season, which means it's much earlier, and they can grow things we can't grow here. You don't see people growing apricots here.
Right. Well, and that really puts things in perspective as we sort of stroll down the way and look at these various vendors. I think for most of us, it would never dawn on us that this guy selling fruit or this woman selling fruit drove all the way from Michigan this morning. I mean, that sort of puts an extra sheen on some of the things that you're looking at.
And the beauty of it is that you can talk to those vendors and ask them about their farm. You can ask them what day they picked their fruit, which was yesterday or this morning. You know, that kind of thing is that you can't do that at a grocery store. Ask the person that actually grew it.
Right, because they're not there.
Right.
You know, a couple of things you should know, that we don't have reselling on fruit and vegetables. Let me make that clear, though. When I say reselling, we do have reselling, but they can't buy wholesale. They may buy from another farmer, which is okay as long as it's less than half of what they're selling. But it's fresh, and there's a big difference between having fresh produce. And I'm not picking on the grocery stores because I shop for produce in a grocery store too. But there is a difference between wholesale produce and fresh farm produce. When it's fresher, it tends to be sweeter. It tends to be ripe. We have a marvelous system in this country providing food through grocery stores. But the trade-off has been, when was it picked, how was it picked, and then how long has it been around? And it's not atypical for produce to be picked underripe, green. It could be 2 months old. It's hard to believe. They keep it refrigerated. They do a great job of keeping that quality up, but it's still not the same as something that's fresh.
Yeah.
Tomatoes, corn are probably the two strong examples of it. And I think people should really pay attention when they buy tomatoes. Cut it open, see if it's red inside. If it wasn't red inside, then it was picked green. Likely it was picked green. or was picked too early. And the same thing of corn. Corn converts the sugars to starches immediately after picking. We have one vendor that comes out of Wonder Lake, Twin Gardens. They have their own patented corn. They bred it. It's not GMO. They bred this corn to be so sweet that you can eat it raw.
Mm.
All right,
and we're there's people walking down the market eating a cob of corn. the
and
samples.
They pick it and refrigerate it to slow down that process of the sugar conversion. And beginning of the season, there's a couple of things this leads into. I guess one is many markets limit the exchange of food to about 100 miles or 50 miles. And we decided right from the onset that there's things that simply don't grow here, so that we thought that market area to be larger. That was that Michigan touch.
Hmm.
So we allow anything from the adjacent states. Now, we've yet to receive any farmers from Minnesota or Iowa, but we certainly have Indiana, Michigan, and Illinois vendors.
Hmm.
And what that does is it gives us a bigger variety of product.
Hmm.
So the corn, they have farms that run from Mississippi all the way through Wisconsin, and they do not bring it from Mississippi. They asked. They said, it's not an adjacent state. They said, okay, we'll follow that. But as soon as they're picking it in Illinois, and I would expect their corn will be in the next couple of weeks, next 3 weeks maybe. We do have corn already. We have one vendor who's Smith has been getting corn out of southern Illinois. So we have some corn.
We're speaking with Ray Vorgiani and Melanie Hovey about Harbor Market, and of course that is open for business right down in exciting fashion every Saturday in downtown Kenosha, and the Westosha Market will be opening this coming Wednesday afternoon on the grounds of the Kenosha County Fair. Melanie, I know that you are presiding over something that's very, very exciting, and it's a venture which in a sense puts some of this delicious, fresh, wholesome food that Ray was just describing so eloquently, makes it accessible to a slice of the population that otherwise really couldn't even probably seriously contemplate purchasing this kind of food with just, you know, the money in their pocket. Tell our listeners about this.
Well, the USDA has been trying to enable people that are on SNAP benefits, you know, food share benefits, to be able to shop at markets. So they facilitated the market's ability to connect with individual vendors. So what the families do is come to me with their EBT card. I process their card and give them wooden tokens to shop with. And then the farmers at the end of the day bring the tokens to me and I write them a check. So it's too cumbersome for individual farmers to be able to partner with the USDA, but market as a whole, we are able to help individual farmers be able to do that. And so recently, because people don't often change their shopping habits, we decided that an incentive program would be a really good idea. And Kennel Manufacturing and Kenosha Community Foundation Women's Fund, and then some private donors, put up some money that is matching the dollars. So if a family comes and asks for $20 to shop with from their EBT card, then I'll give them $40 to shop with. So it's matching dollar for dollar up to $20. So they'll have double money to shop with.
Wow. So what's the response been so far?
Excellent. It's everybody's kind of hearing about it a little bit, and then every week more and more people are coming and really getting the idea that they can buy CSAs, they can, you know, that will give them a box of good fruit and vegetables every single week, or some of the meat products, but then they can just shop on a daily basis, and they've been coming in droves.
Terrific. Yes. So glad to hear that. Ray, in the few minutes that remain, we should give you a chance to talk about what I know are continuing hopes and dreams that you and your colleagues have about the possibility of expansion, the market expanding into more of a year-round permanent home and so on. Just tell us where some of that is at the moment.
Well, let's paint the picture first, and that is ultimately, if you look at markets worldwide, they often start as open-air markets. and they evolve into what's called public markets, that where they're open all week or at least most of the week. They're in an indoor facility. They have permanent vendors. Typically, they would be a bakery, a butcher, a fishmonger, produce, and some prepared food. I don't care if you're in Barcelona or you're in Tokyo. That's what you'll find. And there's certainly some very classic ones in this country. St. Lawrence Market is the one I was trying to think of earlier in Toronto. But you've got Reading Terminal and Philadelphia, Pike's Place in Seattle. Even some new ones, which are already classic, like the Oxbow in Napa. They're just great places. And that's what the goal is, to produce something like this for Kenosha. Now, this is not an easy undertaking. This is a challenge. We're not the size of Seattle or the size of Philadelphia or certainly the size of New York. Or in that matter, Napa is a lot smaller than Kenosha, but there's a lot more, great deal more disposable income there. But the game is to develop over time a public market. We know that's a few years away. We had a feasibility study undertaken, which gave us some really good goals and understandings of the internal workings. So we're working on that. We're working with Kenosha Area Development Corporation, the Chamber of Commerce, UW Extension, the City of Kenosha, Kenosha County, and
CABA.
I said CABA first.
I'm sorry.
I already got that one. I didn't use the abbreviation, though.
Oh, okay.
And to make that happen, we also determined from that study, and all those people out there don't like studies, but I have to tell you, when the private sector does something successfully, they do studies first to determine how to get it done, what's needed. A few things were identified of the internal workings, and one that it should be more than just a public market. It also it should have assembly area, but it also should have a demonstration kitchen, and it should also have a processing kitchen. Now, the processing one is kind of interesting for the lay people. This is good news that when you buy food that's been made, it has to be made in a kitchen that's been inspected by the health department for health reasons. It's a really good thing so we don't die.
Right.
That's a problem, though, for a beginning vendor and even for a small vendor. Where do they make it? They can't make it in their house. They have to make it in a licensed facility, and those aren't readily available. Frankly, there are none in Kenosha. You can go to Racine, to Halo. You can go to Madison, the feed kitchen. Thank you. There's several up in the Green Bay area. And the interim step is we'd like to get that started from now. The view is we start with a temporary processing kitchen and then build that clientele. And then when the public market gets built, then we move the temporary kitchen into a bigger kitchen and let it grow. So we're working very hard with the target of next fall to have a processing kitchen somewhere in the downtown.
And what makes this so difficult? I mean, is it just that it has to align with very strict guidelines? Does it even look like a normal kitchen? I mean, what puts it?
We'll blame it
sort
on,
of out of easy reach.
We'll blame it on stainless steel. these kitchens are expensive. They used to be maybe 15 years ago that if you spent $30,000 on a kitchen, that meat. That number's got to be probably closer to $45,000, $50,000 today. But you're looking at a high-grade kitchen that's easily kept clean. It's not something you do in your home. You have to be able to segregate things so there's no cross-contamination.
And versatile, because there's a variety of different users.
Right.
So different kinds of appliances would be needed.
So it's the money part. If you're an individual, and there are people that have done this. I know a couple of people have built their own kitchen, but it's really, really expensive. And for someone who is trying to start a business, that's a hill a little bit too tall. It makes much more sense to have it at a community level, where the individual can rent space on an hourly basis, and that now doesn't make that hill so big. It's a lot smaller. They can concentrate more on their product and their marketing rather than trying to figure out rather than mortgaging their home.
Right. How would it be different from the kitchen in a restaurant?
A little different. Not that much different. A little bit different processing equipment. But typical kitchen will have burners and ovens, and they'll have mixers, but what you would find in a processing kitchen a little bit more so, plus a lot more storage.
So a its scale would be one of the things that would
Would, I mean, you're going to assume that you have to have commercial level mixers, several of them. You also need much more storage, refrigeration, because you really don't want the vendors taking the product home and bringing it back. That's a risk factor. And this may even help in terms of the food trucks, you know, for their storage as well.
Hmm. So you're working on a couple of things. One of them is the money to actually construct such a kitchen, and the other thing is location. I mean, where would such a thing be located?
We're looking downtown. We're looking at several buildings. I don't like to spend a lot of time on that because it's speculative.
Sure.
Having worked with the government, as soon as you start talking about locations, the cash register starts to climb. What we're concentrating on instead is to determine who would be the customers, because you really want to start this thing on a run so that when it opens, there's customers ready to come in the door. And because it's still a business, you still have to have the revenues exceed the expenses, so you want to start it strong right from the beginning if possible. So we have a survey for people who are in food processing already or hope to be in food processing. We'd like them to take. I would love to give you the address. I have it, but it's really a long address. But you can take it on the web. It's available to anyone. But it's a long address. fyi.uwex.edu/kenosha/kitchen/2016/05/16 kitchen-user-survey/. So what you want to do is go to our Facebook page.
Yeah, there you go.
And hopefully we get it up on our webpage as well so that you don't have to try to write this all down.
Right. It's like War and Peace.
If you're someone, or the other alternative is to give me a call and I can give you the address. But if you're in food processing now and you want a place either to expand into, because this happens too. You can have a restaurant that does catering, and they get a big order, and they just don't have enough space.
Right.
And they got a small kitchen, so this space would be available. You can come in, do the processing, refrigerate it, and then get it to wherever it has to be. It could also be used for weddings. Not so much weddings, but if you hire a caterer and you want to taste the food, where did they do it?
Right.
So
right.
That's part of the demonstration kitchen. There's a place you can come to do the food tasting.
Huh.
But the survey is really important. It's a user survey. It's one of the things that's been pointed out we really need to have a strong handle on so that we know there is a strong enough base. That said, there is no doubt in my mind this is desperately needed in the community. We're an interesting county because of our location. I guess that's not that surprising, but our location near the third biggest market in the country, Chicago, there's a demand for high-level foods. Food processors have an opportunity to really start and grow a business. The anomaly is that's happening already, but it's on a larger scale. We have a surprising number of food processors in our industrial parks producing high-level products.